You are listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
Ancient tools and burials, plants and seeds, Neanderthals. All these things we make no apology, are the study of archaeology. But we don't do dinosaurs.
Welcome to the Archaeological Fantasies Podcast, episode 72. I'm your host, Sarah Head, with my co-hosts today, Ken Fader and Jeb Card. And today we're joined by special guest, Sharon Hill, of Doubtful News, and her new podcast, 15 Credibility Streak. Today we're talking about ley lines. What are they? How can I find them? And can they be weaponized? Get ready to think critically.
No, we don't do dinosaurs. No, we don't do dinosaurs. No, we don't do dinosaurs. No, we don't do dinosaurs.
Hey, everyone, and welcome to the Archaeological Fantasies Podcast. I am your host, Sarah, and I am joined today by my co-hosts, Ken Fader and Jeb Card. How's it going, guys?
It's going. I don't know how it's going, but it's going.
Yep, back to reality from the Society for American Archaeology meetings.
That's right. You guys just went to conference.
We did. Yeah, and yes. Jeb and Dave organized the symposium, and it went, I thought, really well. It was literally standing room only for part of it.
We had a lot of people. We had some really great papers. Joseph Laycock was a great discussant. David Anderson, who we've had on recently for our archaeology and geekery, because he wanted to talk a lot about D&D, and previously on earlier, organized a great thing, and you'll be hearing more about that in the future. Maybe we'll get some new guests out of that.
Absolutely.
But we do have a guest host with us today, and it is returning champion Sharon Hill from Doubtful News and I Doubt It podcast, or I Doubt It website. And you have a podcast out now?
Right. Hi, everybody. Yeah, we have a new podcast out. It's called 15 Credibility Street, and extra points if you know where that title comes from.
I don't.
I found out when, so last night where I was having trouble downloading it from iTunes, as well as our show, actually. But I Googled it and I figured it out, so I will not give it away.
That's going to be our surprise for our 15th episode, which is coming up next
week. Okay.
You have to be a fan of comedy.
Okay.
So it's related to that. And you won't find much on Google, but to me, it just rang true with something original. And here's a pro tip. Start your podcast or anything with a number and it shows up at the top of a list.
Yeah. Well, it's a great title.
Start with the letter A.
It's
even better though if you start your podcast with archaeology, only spell archaeology with three A's.
Yeah, you could be like a plumber. Yeah.
Yes, right. AAA plumbing. Archaeology.
Apparently, that's what the American Anthropological Association was thinking when they went for that. AAA. So,
that or carpenter.
So Sharon is joining us today to talk about ley lines. On our podcast, we have mentioned these a few times, made some jokes about it, but we've never really delved into what the ley lines are and how they affect the fringe world and if they affect archaeology. So, Sharon, can you give us a little bit of background on what ley lines are and why they're a thing?
Well, what are ley lines? Well, that depends on who you ask, because the definition has changed over time. Originally, it was called a discovery of these lines, these linear features, by an amateur archaeologist, Alfred Watkins. And I guess he first proposed it in like 1921. He ended up writing a book a few years later, and then another book a few years after that. So it's like they'll put the origin of this idea that he named ley lines around 1925, something around there. Now he proposed it as straight line trackways, sort of like dead straight trackways that he saw that connected or alignments of sites of special significance. Things like mounds, long barrows, moats, ponds, ancient churches, holy wells, henges, standing stones, all these things across the British countryside that he saw were in alignment. And he was the first to know. He wasn't the first to sort of think about this idea. I guess others had thought. Somebody speeding down the street.
Yeah, that's we've got it's
just wait it out.
Wait it out.
This is the opening weekend. Last week was the opening weekend for the fishing derby, which is right across from my house.
So you got a lot of guys going home
now on motorcycles holding their fishing poles.
I thought you were saying that there were going to be fish on motorcycles.
Well, if they're trying to escape from some of these guys with these poles, I wouldn't be at all surprised.
So I presume we are not keeping this.
Whoever's editing, please chop that little bit out there.
Sorry, Sharon.
I'll start again.
Yeah.
Watkins was apparently not the first. He was not the first to note that these alignments may exist, but he was the first to name them. And then he popularized them. And I think, Jeb, you're the one who told me how important this was for the people of Britain at the time. But let me just run through the chronology real quick. And I'd like you to hit back on why Watkins' idea was so great. But then around the 30s, I think we started to get the first inkling of some mystical aspect, because Watkins' idea was pretty straightforward. There was nothing magical about it. He had a reason why he thought that these were like the street signs of the old times. Right. You know, people sort of looked for the next point to go to.
He writes about them that way, and we'll get back to this, but you often hear in the sort of secondary literature that, Watkins thought of it as entirely mundane, not supernatural. But one book that we will probably rely a lot on is Creating Prehistory, Druids, Lay Hunters, and Archaeologists in Pre-War Britain by Adam Stout. And he does document, using historical records, a lot of historical records, actually, that, and again, we'll talk about this, but the groups that followed Watkins, and even Watkins himself, did begin to give it more like the meaning it has come to take on. Not exactly, but it would, that line between it was mundane and it was more than mundane got crossed a lot earlier than you often hear.
Here's my question, though. So is he saying that ancient people were aware of these linear alignments and said, we'll put our henge here because it's a ley line? Or were they doing this unaware that such things existed and unaware that they were being somehow directed by this anomalous energy to
neither
build their sites there?
Sharon, you go ahead and take this, but at that time, the way they were arguing was neither.
And it gets really confusing, because when you go into the idea that they are earth energy lines, which comes along pretty soon afterwards, like in the 50s, mm-hmm. they ended up being lines of mystical energy, maybe, that were guiding UFOs into the Earth.
Think of the scene in like the Lord of the Rings, where they have the tower after tower after tower as
right.
signaling devices.
Hills.
Beacon hills, yes. It was more like that to begin with, was the idea.
Oh, all right. Okay.
Yeah. So it was not supernatural, maybe.
Yeah, but by the 60s, when you had people like John Mitchell really get into the whole idea of earth energies, and then it got into that whole idea of these are lines of mystical energy. They are currents in the earth generating. There's some sort of energy along the currents, and then it gets really muddled, because I don't know if the energy is there or if the energy is being generated. And there's these ideas about it being a lost power source. The earth is generating these currents, and maybe we can tap into it. And one of the greatest ideas I heard of was that, and I'd like to talk about this a little bit separately, and it's kind of like a whole other sub idea, is that it was almost like earth acupuncture. If you put the standing stone into the ley line, you plugged it in like the needle.
Yes. Absolutely. And
it was like earth had chakra lines. And right.
Some literally describe, like, you may think we're talking about that as an analogy or a metaphor or even like maybe sarcastically.
No.
Some very non-ironically describe it that way, and they actually mean it that way, as it's the same thing.
I like that one. And my other favorite one is the untapped power source, the earth energy power source, because apparently, and correct me if I'm wrong on this one, but isn't the big obelisk in Egypt, isn't that supposed to be like a giant broadcasting tower for the earth energies? Because isn't it on like one of the major ley lines?
Well, this is one of the things that, and I again, Sharon, take over. One of the things I find fascinating about ley lines is once the idea is established of just lines of power, mm-hmm. there are so many different takes on that idea. So the you're all asking, is it like this? Is it like this? Is it like this? And pretty much after 1960, the answer is yes for someone.
Sharon?
Yeah, it's amazing how many things. Yeah.
No, go ahead. Sorry.
It was amazing how many things you could connect to ley lines these days. Once they got, like you said, once they got paranormalized, they were like, you can connect them to anything. So, like, I was able to find them connected not only to UFOs, but also dowsing. It was a big deal that they were connected to dowsing. Fairy paths, spirit ways, mental communication lines. They were the location of these power sources, these buildings or sites. Or they were, now they were known by secret societies. So the Knights Templar had knew where they were, or knew how to use them, and castles were built there. And
that's a pretty common one. Yeah,
it was crazy how many different Orgone energy was also.
Oh,
mentioned.
yeah, which is Wilhelm Reich, right. Which is, it sounds like ozone, but it actually at least does to some degree involve like Kundalini and orgasm.
What?
Yeah, yes. I'm not too well versed with that. Wow. You're clear of that one.
And here's the thing: if you go online and look for ley lines, I have found these drawings of the globe where the almost every spot on the earth is on a ley line. There, in fact, there are more ley lines than there are open spaces between them.
Yeah,
ley lines.
Those are the ones
sort of
I
looks
love.
Like you took. It sort of looks like you took the thing of pixie sticks or pickup sticks, you know, the game, and just dropped them everywhere.
Yeah.
And each one of us right now is probably statistically likely to be on a ley line on one of those maps.
Well, I know I am. That's how I'm powering my house.
So the more sites they would find, the more data you add to this idea, the worse it gets. Because now everything is on a ley line.
Sure.
And it loses its meaning. That's how I saw it when I see these maps of that. I have one in my blog post about it of Seattle, and there's all these lines all over Seattle.
Yeah, and there's all these YouTube videos you can pull up, often tied into kind of end time theology, conspiracy stuff, etc., where they'll have these maps and they're tying them into like Sandy Hook truthers.
Yeah.
And devil conspiracies. And I mean, it's basically. We've talked about Michael Barkun's book Culture of Conspiracy in America, where he's like, once something is kind of in the forbidden gutter, it metastasizes into everything else, and that's exactly what you find here. Now, the other book that I think is fantastic on the whole, what you guys are talking about, the pattern problem, is Ley Lines in Question by Tom Williamson and Liz Bellamy. I had never heard of this book. When I was working on my own book, I ran into it only because I was visiting my parents and their library happened to have it. It's actually not that common. It's really amazing. It's like, it's both a good social history and a solid, like, why this doesn't work.
So
and
before
it's not
we,
that hard to get once you find out about it.
So before
University
we get...
libraries carry it.
Yeah, libraries are great. And before we get too much further into this stuff, let's describe what a ley line, like, physically is supposed to be. It's my understanding that a ley line is a literal line of energy that runs between two or more points, and the more points, the better. So, like, there, of course, is a ley line that runs through Stonehenge and connects with, I don't know, numerous other sites. But it's, if you were to make a map of ley lines, you could draw a physical line on a map from point A to point B.
One of the beautiful things about... One of the beautiful things about Williamson and Bellamy is, so there's multiple definitions, but Watkins gave one. And Sharon, you may have it at hand. I don't know if I do. But he's like, there should be 5 points within X number of miles that are on a line. And really, the social context of this is the ordnance survey maps. And I don't know my USGS in some ways as much. Sharon, can you talk about what this kind of map generally is?
Not really. Okay. I'm not as familiar with them because the term was strange. But I guess it's just like people walking across the land and actually doing physical surveying.
Yeah, well, the ordnance maps, of course, they come from the military. So we're all in the United States, we're often familiar with USGS, which are these nice, detailed maps. You know, you can get quad maps of everywhere.
1 to 24,000 scale.
Yeah, the equivalent in the UK, and I suspect these are older, because they start in the 19th century, are the Ordnance Survey maps. And they are the same idea, made for military and state purposes, but then given to the public as a public good, just like GPS later would be as well. And they made sure on these to mark out things like ruins and pathways. So in essence, they were maps of the landscape that emphasized points of interest as well as contours, as well as locations. And we've talked about apophenia in the past. And once you get like a map full of dots, humans will connect the dots. So Watkins early on created this definition that there should be X number, I think it's 5, in X space. And that was what people could do. They could go and go, ah, if I look at this, there should be a line. And then people would go walk these lines as part of a longer tradition of enjoying the sort of ancient landscape, and we'll get more into that, of the UK. But the USGS maps, or excuse me, the Ordnance maps, some of which were being made by early archaeologists, became the sort of fuel for ley lines.
Actually, I think Watkins said that by 4-point alignments are not going to be accidental. They're going to be some sort of a design, which is kind of ridiculous too, because like you said, once they find 4 points and then they go and they walk the line and then they find a couple more things along the line, and then they've added points to the line. Well, they're only looking on the line.
Well, there's two issues here. One, they're looking on the line. Two, one of the things, again, and one of the reasons I recommend Williamson and Bellamy on this is while they go through the social history, they also do this. Like, they literally test it and they walk through and they show the problems. It becomes a matter of what's on the line, like what fits on the line and how close is a match. You know, does one tiny little corner of a church, does that count? Does, you know, 50 feet off count? Does 100 feet off count?
Like how perfectly,
Well, and I think, Jeb, you've mentioned it, and I know Sharon's mentioned it, that as time passes, they started adding more modern structures to the ley line configurations.
That's the other problem. That's the other problem, that it's a palimpsest. A palimpsest is a term that has a bunch of different meanings, but in archaeology, we use it to refer to when you have a surface or a layer where a huge amount of time is basically stuck yellow. Like if you're in a cave, for example, not a lot of soil deposition in caves. Things don't easily wash. I mean, there are some caves where things wash in, but let's say there's not. You might have layers that take thousands of years that are a couple of centimeters thick, in which case stratigraphy is not going to be your friend. Everything's kind of mixed up on the same level. If you look at the landscape, of course, the landscape is inherently a palimpsest. So you might have an Iron Age monument over there, and you may have a Bronze Age henge over there, and you might have a 17th century road marker over there, an 11th century cathedral over there, and a 6th century Anglo-Saxon mound over fort over there, and a Roman site over there. Watkins and his fellows said those were all okay. Like, those were all fine to draw a line, even though they might be separated by 4,000, 5,000, 6,000 years.
Well, time doesn't seem to be an issue when it comes to determining where the ley lines are, because
they collapse it. They purposely collapse it.
Right, so Sharon, aren't the ley lines supposed to be something like inherent, like some kind of earth energy kind of thing?
Yes, and that is another thing that's very interesting, because when you're talking about things across the surface of the earth, straight lines don't make sense.
Right.
And my interest in ley lines was sort of like, does this have anything to do with the geology? Because obviously, you know, I was interested in that aspect. I'm a geologist, and I was wondering if there's anything I could find in the geology that might have bolstered this idea of straight lines or ley lines. And I did investigate a couple of things. So maybe that we could talk about that idea of why it might sound plausible, but it's really not.
Yeah, let's go to break, and when we come back, we will pick up on that topic.
Would you like to get more involved with archaeology? Are you looking for volunteer or internship opportunities? Are you already working on community or personal archiving projects and could use some helpful hints? Check out the Ideas portal, sponsored by Codify. Visit ideas.codify.com a free and open community tool and share your ideas, knowledge, and advice on select topics that will lead to vibrant opportunities and initiatives for all aspects of archaeology, from fieldwork to public service. All ideas are welcome, so visit ideas.codify.com today and make your voice heard. That's ideas.codify.com.
And we are back. And Sharon, you were explaining to us some of the things that you were investigating when you first started getting into this whole ley lines, earth energy thing.
Right. So if there are such things as earth energy or earth current, it's got to be something to do with the bedrock or the soil or water flow or something geological. You have to have a way to transmit this electrical or electromagnetic energy. And a lot of times I would see mentioned that the earth current is electromagnetic or, but the problem is that we've not been able to actually measure these things. We can't measure these lines. They just don't appear. We could set on an array of electrodes and do electrical resistivity or conductivity, and we just don't see these long lines across the surface of the earth. So number one red flag, we can't measure it. We can measure.
Now, before you go on, there, in case our listeners, some might go, wait, there was an attempt. There was Paul Devereaux and his Dragon Project. Are you going to talk about that?
1977, right?
Something around that, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, the Dragon Project was an attempt to look for these things. And there's a quote by Devereaux that says, most stories about these energies had no foundation in fact. They did not find these energy lines. They found other things.
Yeah, they started focusing more on acoustics.
Right. And so they would find these strange phenomenon that would occur at like standing stones or places where people would have dreams or things like that. So they thought that maybe there was some sort of earth phenomenon going on there. But these long lines of continuous energy or current were not to be found. And I mean, that makes sense because bedrock underneath the ground is heterogeneous. It's not the same. It's got faults. It has fractures. It changes lithologies. And it changes conductivity. Water flows maybe through this fracture set over here, but it doesn't flow over there. So if we're talking about something like electrical conductivity, it is not consistent and it is not in a straight line.
But Sharon,
but there is one. Yeah.
Isn't that what makes one location more magical and special than another location? Is the fact that they are different by the bedrock? I'm asking sarcastically.
Well, yeah, that's a whole other episode you guys need to have about stone tape and...
We have had the stone tape episode, yeah.
Yeah, and I figure we might talk a little bit about that here because they're not unrelated topics. But yes, we did in our Hexam Heads episode. We talked a bit about the stone tape in the last third, yeah.
But Sharon, do any of these people though say, well, the Earth has a magnetic field and there are magnetic lines and the compass points north, and so maybe there's something like that that we just cannot measure, but that ancient people could sense and therefore built their structures along those unmeasurable lines of force, whatever that means.
Yes, of course they say that because the ancients had this sort of engineering that we can't fathom today, right?
Yes.
But there are two things that I think might have played into this. And one is popularly associated with it and the other one is not. The first one is telluric currents.
Right.
Which are real things.
What are telluric currents?
Telluric currents are earth currents. So they are real things that the earth does have. Like I said, the bedrock or the water is conductive in some places. And you can generate an earth current. It's very weak, but it can be generated from the core of the earth, you know, the mantle moving and generating these currents from underneath. And of course, there's the geomagnetic influence from the atmosphere, the solar wind coming and hitting us. And it does generate these earth currents, you know, and then lightning will hit the earth and you'll get that brief burst of current too.
See, it's really funny when you said telluric, you know, I know about the geomagnetic field of the earth and all that, but whenever you say telluric, my first thought is actually to go to bullshit because that is what it is so commonly invoked in these kinds of contexts. Like that's now where which I guess for some people is kind of like quantum mechanics, quantum physics is real, but so many people refer to it to talk about like, you know, whatever the hell they want to talk about. Yeah. Right.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. It's convenient, isn't it? Because there's a kernel of truth to it. And if you don't know your science, you're easily buffaloed by it. And I, to be honest, I had to look up telluric currents because they're just not used very often. And in fact, we can't map them. We can't model them well after decades. They've been highly studied. And we can't map them because there's just so many factors underground that would lend itself to either being conductive or resistant. So they're not altogether useful. People hope that they would be useful. They're kind of not. What's useful is when we as scientists go and stick electrodes in the ground and do very short range surveys. And we can tell if there's maybe sinkholes underground or if there's, a whole bunch of clay over here.
And archaeologists use resistivity and conductivity to find walls, to find soil deposits. It's along with ground penetrating radar and magnetometry. It's what we call remote sensing to peer under the ground.
Exactly. So that, I think, like you said, it's used so often that it has actually become this useful trope. The second thing that I looked at was these actually real long straight lines in geology that are called lineaments. And they result in, you find them by looking at maps. Usually you have to do the stereo views of the maps and you can see these structural lineaments that go for maybe, very long stretches.
By stereo, you mean like the old school, like 3D sort of, okay, where you have two pictures and you're looking at through a stereoscope.
Yep, you got to look at them in stereoscope. Right. And you're able to find these long linear features. And they're related to things like, contact boundaries or fracture zones or faults, where there are long stretches of straight features. And these usually are areas of weakness because they're fracture zones. So they're highly conductive of water, usually. They're a great place to drill a municipal well. So it's become a science to actually try to look for these lineaments and then go out and field truth them. And if you drill into them, you might have a better chance of getting a really high producing well. So they are sort of a real thing. And I thought, well, maybe in an ancient setting, people noticed these things because there wasn't a whole lot of stuff going on around, or there was vegetation that was connected to that fracture zone because there was so much water there, that maybe these were related to ley lines. I have yet to find that connection at all. But that was the only thing that I could think of that might
actually give it some kernel of truth, but right now it doesn't look like it.
Yes, because I think maybe there's ponds and holy wells aligned with this thing. Doesn't seem to be a thing.
So you have found no physical evidence of ley lines?
No.
All right.
They're purely imaginary.
Podcast over.
Yeah, as I say, podcast done. Yeah.
So
we will race it every episode from here on out. Like, when can we put this to bed?
Right. So now that we have established that ley lines are not real, I mean, as far as it does not meet it doesn't meet the criteria that we have laid out in past episodes for being a real thing. What is this fascination? Why do ley lines persist? And I'm just going to let the two of you dig that one out.
I think there's a lot of good reasons why they persist. And when I started thinking about it, I just kept coming up with more and more. One of the reasons that triggered me to start writing about ley lines was actually the reason, and then the reason why I finally started to write about them, were ghost hunters. And they like the idea of ley lines because it provides a very sciencey sounding explanation for some weird thing that they want to explain in a sciencey way. So it's a handy thing to use when you're trying to make something sound plausible and you're trying to explain these paranormal things. So I was at a conference and one guy, when I found out I was a geologist, he came over and he was a ghost hunter. He asked me what I knew about ley lines. I'm like, I'm not quite sure what I know about ley lines. So I started reading up on it. And then I watched the latest Ghostbusters movie, Ghostbusters 2016, and there were ley lines as the main plot device of the movie. I'm like, okay, this is it. Back in 2003 was the first time I had seen ghost hunters mention the idea of ley lines. And since then, it's become more popular because it's really, really useful to them. They sound sciencey, and they aim to do that. They aim to impress their clients by how much they sound professional. So I think that's one reason why it's very
useful. And they're compatible with the whole ghost hunter fixation on EM readers and detecting unseen energies.
Unseen energies. That's exactly right. So it was started by an amateur archaeologists, but it's been highly useful for other amateurs because a lot of ideas are like that. You know, they get picked up by cranks. The cranks love these ideas.
And it was in that neighborhood from the very beginning. Like, it wasn't just that Watkins himself, he quickly assembled in the base of the 20s to the 30s. It kind of petered out in the late 30s. And then, as Sharon said, came back in the 60s with when UFO people rediscovered it. Everybody who was into this is sort of these lay hunters, you know, these lay trackers. They were all purposely amateur groups. It was, again, Adam Stout's book talks about this being part of the larger battle between old school antiquarians, those fixated on the landscape, on more historical ruins, often sort of the predecessor of archaeology in some senses, and the rise of scientific prehistoric archaeology, what we would generally consider archaeology today. And ley lines became sort of one of the symbols of that conflict.
Well, you know, what's interesting is, you know, within the field of archaeology, people talk a lot about settlement pattern analysis. It's trying to figure out why sites are distributed across the landscape where they are. And archaeologists will look at things like sources of fresh water or specific resources like lithic resources or clay resources. And those are all very economically based explanations for why the site distribution looks the way it does. But here we have this really cool sounding explanation that no, they are in the arrangement. They are because of some mystical force or unseen force that regular science doesn't even consider. And that works for archaeology, or why are these areas haunted? Why do we see UFOs on the UFO highway? So it's this, again, it's like, as you're saying, it's this alternate explanation that still sounds like it's science.
Yeah. And Sharon, I think you're absolutely right. And Ken, you're echoing this because it makes it predictable. You can now, of course, you can put a ley line wherever you want, like we were saying, but it's like, oh, but of course you're having things here because, well, look at these ley lines. Right. You know, it's just be like, well, of course you have gold here because look at the kind of deposits you have around. It makes it predictable, except since you can throw a ley line anywhere.
I would argue that it makes it not predictable because you can't find the ley line and then go looking for the things on it unless you know what you're looking for.
I might make it clear I am putting predictable in air quotes.
Yeah.
the symbol of being predictable, but of course you can do it anywhere. You know, it's like, you know, if I wave an EM meter around and I find a cold spot in a old drafty mansion, oh, well, of course this is ghosts. Look at what I've got here. It's the same kind of fake predictability, I think, is more what I'm getting at. Now, Ken, you mentioned settlement patterns.
Right.
There are ley line people and there are archaeology people that both argue that the increased interest in landscape archaeology, more not so much settlement patterns, but sort of settlement patterns grading into how people see the land, long-term memory of the land. These are legitimate parts of archaeology. There are some who argue that the rise of that was partly inspired by interest and ideas coming from ley lines. And I don't know how much I evaluate that because it seems like one of those things you could read a lot or a little into.
Right.
And I pulled up, so we mentioned Paul Devereaux. If you go back to the 70s and 80s, Paul Devereaux was very much somebody who would want to talk about, like, not mystical forces, but like parapsychological forces and all of that. And over time, he is moderated. And I have a book of his, Sacred Geography, Deciphering Hidden Codes in the Landscape. And I think it's from 2010. Yes. I don't agree with everything in that book, but he has moved into largely places that are a lot less, I think, scientifically problematic. Like, he talks about spirit roads and such, but he largely seems to have found a middle ground where he is actually comfortable saying, you know, alongside landscape archaeology. He's at least one of these people. A lot of these people are not, but he has moved in that direction of wanting to find meaning in the landscape. And that would be my big reason why this has persisted. We've mentioned Max Weber, the very important early social thinker, sociologist, history of religion, other stuff. And his most famous thing is he talks about how modernity disenchants the landscape, the rise of the Enlightenment and rational inquiry. Disenchants the landscape of mysticism and wonder, and how in the modern period you have other ways of re-enchanting the landscape. I think ley lines, that's exactly what they do.
Matches, yeah, precisely.
I even had that written in my notes, re-enchantment. That was definitely a feature that I saw. The whole idea about earth mysteries and the earth as a living thing was another way of, you know, making everything so much more exciting and romantic and dramatic. That was a couple of something I came across over and over again with thinking about ley lines is the earth is a living thing. You know, it could have energy lines, chi lines, just like people. Yeah. And the idea of, you know, geomancy, putting, it's like feng shui. It's like, where do you put your stuff to make the earth happy or to be in harmony with the earth? So there was very much that sense of new age feel good type things with the earth mysteries popularity.
The thing I think that's worth pointing out is that pretty much every culture does have directionality rules and landscape rules. You know, the church faces east for this reason. We talk about uptown. If I talk about up, down, and downtown, and we generally mean that north, south, not always, but in a lot of cases, those things usually have inherent meanings, or the west side versus the east side. Again, there may be variations, but you can think in our own society of ways of culturally organizing the landscape that maybe we don't invest with supposed supernatural, but frankly, usually one culture's supernatural is another culture's received wisdom in a lot of cases.
Yeah, the whole idea about corpse ways and you know, yep. Maybe it was the shortest route to the cemetery from the church, and it was a straight line. And, you know, could have become imbued with other meaning. Sure. I mean, the fact that there are ceremonially and culturally significant linear features, yeah. And did they get additional supernatural meaning attached to them?
Jeb, I think you mentioned new agey stuff, and so did you, Sharon. I spend as much time as I possibly can in the Southwest, and Sedona is this wonderful, crazy kind of community in northern Arizona. And they don't talk. I haven't heard people there talk much about ley lines, except in this context. Throughout Sedona, you can get maps in every store in Sedona to bring you to the vortexes.
Yes,
and these vortexes are these amazing PowerPoints. The Earth is alive, and you can communicate with Earth spirits or whatever. What people have told me is that the vortexes are located at the intersections of ley lines.
Yes, yeah, that's often how that works.
Are incredibly powerful because you're not on simply one ley line, you're on multiple ley lines all at the same place at the same time.
And I think we're about to take our break. I think when we come back from our break, we can talk about we've been talking about what Watkins thinks and others thinks. Let's talk a little more about how this transitions into sort of larger We've hinted at it. Let's talk a little bit more how this transitions into larger paranormal belief and culture, and then maybe what that produces in terms of, because almost everybody here has probably watched something. We mentioned Ghostbusters, watched something, read something, played something that has ley lines in it. It's become a very popular thing. So maybe we'll start with, we'll talk about Ami Michel, and we'll talk about Ivan Sanderson.
Archaeotech Podcast, hosted by Chris Webby Webster and Chris Boone Sims, is a show dedicated to the technology of the modern archaeologist. On the Archaeotech Podcast, we interview people using interesting tech, and we dig into the issues, advantages, and try to uncover the disadvantages of the digital age and going paperless. We all know there is no paper in the future, or should we say, paper has no future. Check out the show at www.archaeologypodcastnetwork.com/archaeotech. Let's get back to the show.
And we are back. And Jeb, you wanted to give us some names.
Sharon, you had mentioned that this kind of got into UFO land. You want to talk about how that happened?
I don't know that much about it, and I was kind of surprised. There were two names that came up. The idea about Ami Michel.
Yes.
That they were some sort of, these lines were guidelines for UFOs.
Yeah, there was this early idea in UFOs that they were magnetic.
Right. And they were guidelines for the UFOs. And I guess there was this flap of UFO sightings in France, and he thought that they occurred on a straight line. Well, normally things do fly in a straight line, but
he was doing the same kind of like, oh, I can like draw lines between things, just like Watkins was with monuments. And Apophenia found Apophenia, and then they had a small child, and it became the modern version of ley lines. But that reintroduced the concept. He basically rediscovered it. You can go back to the very earliest book on UFOs by Scully, ironically, is the name of the author that talks about this magnetic force thing. Michel reintroduced it with ley lines, though, like late 50s or early 60s, somewhere around there.
I think it was like 58, because then like 60, like that, yeah. 61 was Tony Wedd.
Okay.
And he
I don't know that name. Tell me more.
He had the ideas of orthotenny, where I'm not sure if Michel had the same idea, but it was basically the same thing. When plotted on a map, these things fell into perfectly straight lines.
Yes.
And that's what orthotenny means, I guess. So it was discredited now. It actually didn't work out, but it was for a while the thing in the UFO communities that these things traveled in straight lines. So there must be these energy guidelines that are bringing the UFOs into us to see us.
Yeah, which the interesting thing is, I find it fascinating that very quickly in UFO land, we already start to move away from these are just flying ships and start to move into Earth, even if they were thought of as flying ships, into things tied to the Earth, things tied into pathways. The other name was Ivan Sanderson, and he is a big figure in a lot of what you might call pseudoscientific or quasi-scientific paranormal stuff, because his biggest claim to fame is usually in cryptozoology. Any history of cryptozoology, especially Bigfoot, but other things, including giant penguins in Florida, where he appears to have been fooled. Do you know the story?
Oh yes.
No. Go ahead and tell the story.
So they find these gigantic three-toed footprints, and Sanderson was a zoologist, but he wasn't a academic, and that always sort of, I guess, made him antagonistic to
he always would go on TV and such.
The scientist. Yeah, well, he was a popularizer. He popularized strange things. So he was convinced that these three-toed footprints in Florida, I forget what beach it was.
I don't remember either.
We're from a giant penguin.
Yeah, giant 1950s giant penguin, Florida, because you know, if you're a penguin, Florida is the place to go. Maybe, and I think this was before SeaWorld.
They're warm weather penguins.
Yeah. Well, they're big. They're big, although big would actually go for large. That would actually go for cooler, a la like the plot. Anyway,
too much logic. Too much logic.
That, yeah, it was turned out it was apparently somebody with like giant lead shoes.
Yeah, and it was so obviously a hoax that.
Yeah.
Wow.
Why he? But then again, he also had the whole deal with the Minnesota Iceman too.
Right. That's also his progeny and other things. But he also wrote about like Bermuda Triangle type stuff. And he at one point suggested the idea that UFOs were actually underwater, that they were, that's where they were based, which actually makes some sense, but I could sort of see that making some anyway. But he also talked about vile vortices, that right. There you could draw like geometric lines around the Earth and find Bermuda Triangle like places where you were more likely to have weird shit going on.
It's and supposed to be one in the Sea of Japan, I believe. That's
called the Devil Sea.
Yeah, the Devil Sea. And I don't know if he ever explicitly tied it into ley lines, but this is at the same time in the 60s when ley lines were starting to become a thing again.
Yeah, so there were these concentrations of strange either psychic energy or some sort of energy that were making these phenomena occur. I forget what I was going to say.
basically Sanderson, Michelle was helping with UFOs, but I suspect Sanderson probably helped a great deal in sort of mainstreaming these, since he was a very popular author and he had a lot of kind of pull and credibility in all the various kind of cryptozoology and UFOs and parapsychology. He had some of that. I suspect he was probably one of the major vectors for that too.
And this still comes up. There are these so-called areas of high strangeness.
Yeah.
And so there's these areas where there's concentrated weird things that happen, whether it be
window areas.
Yeah, cryptids or UFO sightings, or strange lights, all sorts of things. And Devereaux was another one who popularized the idea of earth lights. I don't think I'm not sure that they were in relation to ley lines either, but earth lights have become popular in relation to the tectonic strain theory.
Right. And that was Michael Persinger.
Can you describe what earth lights are real quick?
Well, they could be a number of things. They could be balls of light that rise from the ground, balls of light that are floating through the air. They could be glows, things like St. Elmo's fire, Will o' the Wisp, things like that. So they could be real. They could be sort of a static electricity, electromagnetic feature that actually does happen. Or ball lightning sometimes gets thrown into that. Earthquake light sometimes gets thrown into that mix. There's a whole slew of things that qualify as earth lights. We're not really sure if some of them are real or not. I happen to think that there is a basis for some of this stuff, but we just haven't been able to observe enough of them that they're fairly rare. And I do think that they're very localized to specific geology. When you're talking about a fault line,
right?
There are faults that do build up an incredible amount of energy before they release. And that can create some, potentially could create some current and ionize the air.
Whereas on the cultural and historical side, these very nicely fit in, not geologically, because the places you're talking about wouldn't have them, but with, and we talked about this on our Monster Talk crossover with the fairies, the things like fairy lights and treasure lights, where there's a deep, deep lore of places, supposedly you have treasure, that at the middle of night, there might be a light that would rise up at midnight from a mound or somewhere else. And these, you know, Sharon mentioned corpse lights, Sharon mentioned fairy lights before. These all tie together. And again, most of the places where these might be associated with archaeological sites would generally not be geologically sensible from any of the sort of tectonic strains you're talking about. Some might be, but most wouldn't be. So even if this does happen in some places, it's not really what, it doesn't cohere very well with the lore about them.
Let me just make one clarification about the tectonic strain theory. There were two things: either that these lights can be mistaken for UFOs, ghost hunters have glommed onto that idea as well. That there's this sort of energy that's released on these tectonic faults that make people either hallucinate and see these things.
Right.
Okay. And that can sort of that can actually be tied into ley lines too, because you're standing on a ley line or you're standing at the henge and you're feeling an electricity sort of strange feeling. Of course, that's priming. You're induced to feel a little bit weird if you're told that you're supposed to. So
I think that's Michael Persinger. That was his idea in the 70s. The guy who later claims that he's created abductions through his quote unquote God helmet by stimulating the temporal lobe. Mm-hmm. He talked about that with magnetic anomalies and so forth.
Yeah. So there's a whole pile of stuff related to that too.
I actually experienced that in the UK. I was at the Castle Rig, which is this beautiful megalithic stone circle. And I honest to God, felt this vibration and this an pit of my stomach. And then when I looked up at the sky, there's a Royal Air Force base, I guess, on the other side of the mountains, and they like to buzz the people who are all around Castle Rig. So before you can see the jet, you feel this and you look around, and the locals know exactly what's going on. And then streaking across the sky at more than the speed of sound is in fact it's a fighter jet. and the sound, it breaks the sound barrier. There's a big boom. And I actually have a photograph. It's a poor photograph. And I don't have the stone circle in the photograph, but you can see the jet streaking across the sky. And it's so for a very brief moment, I felt I was experiencing that.
Well, that's just like when I went to Stonehenge and Avebury and all that. That's in the area of Salisbury Plain in southern England. And that area is all. So a massive military area for military maneuvers and training and testing. They refer to it as Britain's Area 51 exactly for that reason, because there's a bunch of weird things people report, and there's also a bunch of military. And of course, on the one hand, you could say, oh, people see things because there's things moving. On the other hand, though, I think it's people associate weird things that are sort of secretive with weird things that are sort of secretive on the military side. So, I mean, remember, as soon as crop circles started appearing in Wiltshire around all the stone circles, one of the early ideas was, and some people very much still talk about this, is it microwave weapons? Is it the military testing? And this is the same equation we saw in the late 70s with cattle mutilations and such in the West. Oh, it must be the military doing experimentations. And these are about explaining things and trying to grapple with social power, frankly.
Now, are there any rumors, are there any lines of thought expressed on the internet that the military is trying to militarize ley lines, trying to harness that power?
Oh, I need that to be a thing if it's not.
For weapons.
I am sure it must.
Well, I can't imagine it wouldn't be.
I need a ley line ray gun. That would be amazing. what does it do when you hit people with it?
It only works when you're on the ley line.
No, that would be Tesla's. Okay, no, the answer is yes. That would all involve Tesla. One of I think I linked you guys to a YouTube video where of this stuff that was all apocalyptic news.
Right.
I didn't even watch it. I just read the description where they're like, oh, there was an explosion on a Connecticut beach. I guess apparently somebody, this was about a year ago, you guys might remember, somebody like created this old ordinance. They were saying that was actually the result of, and they were like, at the same time in Russia, like 32 people die at a military base, and they were saying that's exactly what it was.
It was on a ley line, right.
That it was a weaponization experiment. Yes.
So ley lines are dangerous, is what I've learned.
Well, they're powerful. In the wrong hands, yes.
In the wrong hands. Can they affect the weather? Are they our sleeping weather machine that we haven't okay, anyway, I've got us way off topic.
Gonna bring up harp is what's gonna happen next.
You're bringing up what?
No, we don't even want to go into harp. No.
Oh no.
Yeah, that's something completely different. But the beauty about ley lines is you can make them whatever you want them to be.
Yeah, pretty much.
Well, we were talking off air before we came back about how, and I know we've mentioned this case on a podcast before, especially when we talked with Brad Lepper about the group that went out to the Serpent Mound and was burying crystals inside of the Serpent Mound for various reasons. So, yeah. And that was,
we're going collector too.
Yeah. That was to tap the supposed ley line that runs through the Serpent Mound to get whatever energies.
It was to open up like a rainbow bridge on the Maya solstice of 2012.
I don't know. Sure.
Something like that.
I don't know.
Serpent Mound was also the focus of an episode of Ancient Aliens because there's apparently iridium in the soil beneath it. So that
it is on an impact crater. I mean, it's on the edge. It's on the edge of a very old, like 200 million years old or something, impact crater.
Right, and that's why there's iridium. But so in Ancient Aliens, they maintained that was fuel used. Those were the equivalent of dilithium crystals.
Sure,
for use in the UFOs.
Sure.
So did the extraterrestrial aliens build the serpent so when they flew over it, they would know where to land? I didn't get the connection between the Serpent Mound and
I'd like to believe that there's actually a giant alien serpent that is sleeping beneath the mound and will arise when the stars come.
Right. Well, you guys, you're missing the obvious. It's not actually a serpent. You know that, right?
What is it?
It's really a giant sperm.
Yeah.
It even depicts like the section of the tail that breaks away after the sperm has gotten through to the great cosmic egg. I mean,
I spoke to the manager of the site, and he said that for a time he was having to chase people off of that thing because in the middle of the night they'd show up to have sex on the serpent to improve the likelihood that they would.
I think we've learned that pretty much anywhere has that problem.
That does seem to be a thing.
Every archaeological site ever, I think, has that problem. Actually,
I guess. But there's also the claim that the Serpent Mound is in fact that Southern Ohio was the Garden of Eden, and the Serpent Mound is the serpent from the Bible that tempted Eve.
Ohio is a paradise.
Well, absolutely.
No.
As a state employee,
who you ask.
As a state employee, Ohio is a paradise.
And that just proves the power of employment right there, man.
That was Jeb Card from Ohio University.
I like it here. I'm not going to lie.
It's not a bad place. But there are other locations that are on ley lines. You guys kind of hit on some of the ones that are out in the West. And I know I brought up the Gungiwamp Swamp because I'm just fascinated with the fact that word exists. And it also came up in one of the chapters I just got finished reviewing.
I see that.
America's Stonehenge or Mystery Hill is also considered to be a vortex. Well, and that's the thing with Gungi Swamp. It's got a vortex. We're not going to go into the trail of teary blood or whatever. America's Stonehenge has supposedly got a vortex as well. So these vortexes seem to pop up very frequently.
I mean, Sharon, you said you've been to Sedona. You've been to the vortices there. What other ley-liney places? Because of course they're everywhere. But any particularly dense concentrations that you might have visited?
Well, you know what? You can just walk out your door, I think, and they're right there. I should check Gettysburg. I'm not that far from Gettysburg. I'm certain there's ley lines through there.
I know there's supposed to be one through Bull Run.
Yeah, if there weren't in 1863, I'm sure there are now.
Yeah, there's one in Bull Run that I'm aware of.
Gettysburg is a whole other ball of wax because there's so much that goes on there that people say are paranormal and has such mundane explanations.
I can tell you this. Okay, again, my name is Jeb because my father is a Civil War nerd, all right? I went there almost every summer when I was growing up, and the paranormal stuff largely did not start emerging even at all until the late 80s, and it did not start to become part of the tourist industry there in any real sense until sometime in the 1990s. The whole Gettysburg, most haunted place in America, blah, blah, blah thing is not that old. Like, right. It really is only at most about 25 years old.
Yeah. Well, I think a lot of the big ghost stuff is, though.
Yeah. This is a little off topic, and I don't know enough about this. I bet you, Jeb, Sharon, you probably know more about this. The people who claim that in places where huge battles were fought, that there actually is some electromagnetic imprint left behind.
That's stone tape.
That's stone tape.
Okay,
stuff.
Right.
We'll have to do a whole stone tape episode. I think we just made fun of the video. I don't think we actually talked about.
Well, let's ask Sharon. You said you've seen the movie. We talked about it when we did our Hexam Heads. What did you think of it?
I thought the movie was great. I mean, just what you said. It was a fantastic horror movie. It was kind of creepy. It was different. It was surprising. It was weird to see them, the old timey computers, that things were happening to the computers as well. And the idea that she could hear, but the other people couldn't hear it was interesting. And that does sort of tie into the idea that you have to be on a certain frequency or wavelength in order to pick these things up, where not everybody is. So I like that idea. That was interesting. But yeah, I started to do more research on the stone tape, and there's not a whole lot. I need to get to the SPR. I don't know if there's anything over there. I am a member of this Society for Psychical Research over in the UK. So I might be able to pull a favor for them and ask them to help me to research the origin of stone tape. And from there, I went to the psychometry idea.
Right.
Which is a whole other thing. So these things tie together and merge, and the threads weave and cross. It's funny.
Not unlike ley lines.
Yep. It sounds to me like we've got a bunch of psychic episodes coming up in the future here.
Oh, God.
Yeah, so, I think we could definitely revisit some of this.
So, Sharon, thank you very much. Any final thoughts on ley lines?
Well, I think that, like I said, they're a handy device for non-scientists to evoke to sound sciencey, and they've obviously worked pretty well because they're still around today, even though they don't exist.
Are you sure? Are you sure they don't exist?
I'm pretty sure.
Jeb, final thoughts?
If you can't measure it, it didn't happen.
True story. Jeb?
Well, I've talked about the re-enchantment of the landscape, but honestly, I'd like to spend my final thought in basically thanking Sharon for coming on again, and make sure to listen to her podcast, 15 Credibility Street.
Indeed.
And check out her Spooky Geology, where she's starting to put a lot of these kinds of topics. And she does these long, in-depth, like long reads, not full articles there, but like really long read posts that dive into the history of these ideas, give you examples, and some of them very much tie into archaeology and others do not. And one I might suggest, you did the gate to hell, or the pit of hell, what was it in Uzbekistan?
Yeah.
One I might suggest you might try
Turkmenistan. Yeah.
Is the natural nuclear reactor. Do you know about this?
Nuclear reactor?
Maybe.
Yeah, we'll talk about this. This is a very cool case of a sort of perpetual natural nuclear reaction. I want to say, I could be wrong, but I think Western Africa, I could be wrong about that. That is kind of cool.
I will write that down again. I'm getting all kinds of good ideas from you guys.
Yeah.
That's what we're good for.
New blog post.
We're good for good ideas. Ken, final thoughts?
Here's my final thought. This was a perfect archaeological fantasies podcast. Because in the first 5 minutes, we completely dismiss this phenomenon, right? It doesn't exist. You can draw a line connecting four dots of just about anything, and it doesn't mean anything. But we didn't then say, okay, we're done. Why are we still talking about this? We focused on the more interesting part, which is, why do people believe this? And what does it mean about how they view reality, antiquity? And that's the important part. And so this was great. Thank you so very much, Sharon.
Yeah, my pleasure.
Sharon, thank you very much for being on the show. I appreciate it, and I look forward to having you back on as we continue to delve into psychic phenomena as it relates to archaeology. So
you bet. Thanks.
All right. Guys, thanks very much for being on the show.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
All right.
Ranger trials as one will call. No, we don't do dinosaurs.
Thanks for listening. We hope you've enjoyed it. Our music was provided by Archaeosuit Productions. If you like what you've heard, please subscribe and rate us on iTunes or Stitcher and share us wherever you use social media. You can contact us with your questions, comments, or angry email at archaefantasies@gmail.com. You can follow the podcast at www.archaeologypodcastnetwork.com/archaefantasies. You can follow the blog at www.archaefantasies.com and get updates on Tumblr and Twitter at @archaefantasies. You can also look for us on Facebook. If you're looking for the show notes for this episode, go to the podcast website at www.archaeologypodcastnetwork.com/archaefantasies. Thanks again for listening.
No, we don't do dinosaurs. No, we don't do dinosaurs. We don't do dinosaurs.
This show is produced by Chris Webster and Tristan Boyle, and edited by Chris Sims.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archaeologypodcastnetwork.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.